From WIPR in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Today, another installment of the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. Author, teacher, and salon editor Dee Watkins joins us as we continue to reflect on the 2015 uprising sparked by the death of Freddie Gray. Dee Watkins co-hosts a new podcast that reexamines Freddie Gray's death. 2 years later, have any new details emerged? Disruption seems to be in the air politically. Was the unrest in Baltimore disruptive to people's assumptions about class, culture, and race in America? Did it change the way we talk about race and inequality in Baltimore? Are people better equipped to listen to each other and appreciate the experiences of the other? Does listening lead to change? Sherry Parks and Dee Watkins, they're coming up on Midday, right after the news. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, it's another installment of the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks. Dr. Parks is an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship, and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland in College Park, where she's also an Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Hey, Sherry, good to see you as always.
Hi there.
And we are joined as well in the studio to make some culture connections by the writer Dee Watkins. He's the author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America, and The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. He's also an editor-at-large for Salon.com and a lecturer in the Klein Family School of Communications Design at the University of Baltimore and the founder of the Be More Writers Project. Dee, it's good to see you, man. It's been a while.
Hey, a year exactly. Happy to be back.
Well, glad to have you. You are welcome to join our conversation today, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. And to follow us on Twitter, we're at Midday Tom Hall. So, Sherry, last week and this week, we're reflecting on the two-year anniversary of the uprising that followed the death and funeral of Freddie Gray. That actual anniversary was last Thursday. Disruption has been much in the zeitgeist since the election. I mean, people talk about Mr. Trump as a disruptor. I wonder, in this, as we ponder what's happened in these 2 years since our city was, you know, just convulsed with the kind of violence it hadn't seen in quite a long time. In what ways was that event disruptive? And what other things do you think have been, if there have been things that have been disruptive, and how have they changed the narrative? You've done a lot of work about the narrative, the stories that came out of the uprising. Is this a pivotal moment?
Well, I think, yes, it is still a pivotal moment. The way in which we have responded, I mean, let's talk a bit about what disruption is. You read about it more in business literature, but the idea is that if you have a cultural system, if you really shake it up, and ironically, there were some Trump voters who said, we're going to shake up the system by voting for Trump. But if you take a system and really disrupt it and change it, then it creates the opportunity for change, not necessarily that change happens. And I think, and often people, and I've noticed this in 2 years, people are seeming to focus on the violence. And I separate out the killing of Freddie Gray from the protests, from the violence, because the violence and the protests are two different things, two sets of people who did not have the same agenda. But it's interesting how that now people are beginning to talk about them interchangeably. I think for many people in Baltimore, particularly people who did not know many working-class black people, this was an eye-opening experience. I gave a talk at one of the more elite private schools in the last 6 months, and they said, this was not the Baltimore I knew. I grew up here, and this was not the Baltimore I knew. So I think it did open some people's eyes. I think we also have to worry about what happens because of that, because I think we can say, well, now I know this. Now I'm a better person. But if, and this is something I'm sure Dee is going to talk about, if nothing happens because of that, to what end? Yeah. And there's always that challenge of the system healing over and saying, well, you know, like going to a movie and feeling that you're a better person, of healing over, and then nothing happens. And I think that's why this moment is really pivotal, because if we still have a chance to change some things right now.
Yeah, 2 years hence. I mean, Dee, do you have a sense that, I mean, you're from here, you grew up on the East Side, still live on the East Side. Do you have a sense that that the moment was taken advantage of, or was the moment missed, or was the moment is it a mixed bag about what we learned, if anything, and how we can in fact advance the cause of equality moving forward?
I would say it's a mixed bag. You know, a lot of people who weren't aware of these issues really care. And I had some conversations with some people and some talks with some people who really, really, really wanted to make change. People who were willing to not just, you know, say I love these communities or I care about these people, but people who were willing, you know what, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how this works. Let me just fund this. You know, so people who really wanted to make change. So I always applaud people who try to do what they can do to actually really make a difference. Then I also think the people who don't really care about these people, who don't really care about these things, they already don't care anyway. So, you know, it's something that they can talk about and then it just goes away. They go right back to the Baltimore that they or the America that they know, and everybody else stays the same. But what I do like is the fact that we've had so many young activists emerge because of this situation. And I think me being an older person and like a mentor and, you know, somebody who really, really, really cares about results and quantifiable goals, I can be there to say, look, OK, it's cool to understand the rhetoric. It's cool to understand, you know, you need to understand the history and understand what happened and how we got to this point. But then also to take those skills and that knowledge and share it and apply it and share it and apply it. So for the generation who's coming after, you can have a better experience than what you are going to have.
First, yeah. We have to point out that Dee just said he was an older person.
That's right. I mean, I think we can't lie. I can't front. Like where I'm from, like I'm an older guy.
How
like,
old are you now?
35.
Okay.
Well, and actually, what you mean is that because of what usually happens to black men, the older you get, the more rarer you become.
Sucked up in jail, dead, or thrown into some type of mental institution, like So these people who I'm talking about, like most of the people who like who I'm working with now, like Kantwani Fidel and Tarik Torrey and Shan Wallace, these people like 25, 27, 28 years old. Noah and Damien, young activists, photographers, documenting the movement, telling their stories, wrote a lot of content that's on the Be More Writers Project, 19, 18, 17 years old. So it's like, you know, I'm like, where I'm from, you know, dudes my age, you know, grandmothers is 30. So it's like, and I'm not saying it's cute, it's cool, or it should be like normal. I'm not trying to normalize that type of mentality, but I acknowledge.
You're saying what it is.
It is what it is. You know, mm-hmm. We get caught up saying, well, how come I can't have, you know, a picket fence? It is what it is. You know, we got to take it how it is.
The writer and essayist Dee Watkins, along with Dr. Sherry Parks. It's the Midday Culture Connection. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday here on WYPR 88.1. Sherry, I continue to get emails from listeners who take issue with this term, the uprising. And I'm interested that you make pains to make a distinction between the violence. And I try to do that as well. I try to say the violence and uprising.
What do they want you to call it?
Well, they don't want to elevate the rioters to noble people who are fighting for freedom and equality. They think that that's they bristle at that notion that the people who are on the streets that day or those few days in April of 2015 are somehow noble crusaders for civil rights. This is what they're telling me.
And they are equating.
And they're all white.
And they're equating the riots with the marches.
Yes.
Yeah, right. First of all.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's the first.
When I talk about the uprising, what I am talking about, because for weeks, there were people on the streets who were doing by the book nonviolent organizing and marching by. And I'll tell a story about a very poignant event, because we were talking about, you know, we are in the positions we are in. And, you know, I'm a middle class black woman. And there was an event I had to go to because I had to go do Dean words in the streets at an event in Baltimore. And a march was going by me. And I said, well, I can do what I can do. And I stood there, you know, my dressed up clothes. And I just stood. And what was so interesting, several people walked by. And we were talking about age. I'm a mama in Baltimore. And several people said, thank you, mama. Thank you, mama. And then somebody walked by and said, thank you for the blessing, mama. those are the people that I'm talking about, who were out in the rain and the weather and dealing with those situations. Now, what we often think about as the riots, what wasn't really reported is that the first day there was violence. It was down near Camden Yards.
That was on the Saturday, the 25th of April.
And mm-hmm. and many of the leaders were not there. And
that followed a long day of very peaceful protests.
Right. And there were people, I've now heard this from different sources, who were coming out of Camden Yards who were drunk and started yelling racial epithets at young adolescent black boys. Well, okay, you're a young adolescent black boy.
I was down there.
Am I saying what happened?
Exactly what happened. Those Sox fans came outside of the gate and they approached us.
So you can't go back at them. So they did what, and I'm not saying this was wonderful. I'm simply explaining it. They did what often adolescent boys do. They took it out on property. And because I thought it was very interesting, if you watch the progression of people going down the street there, I mean, they smashed the windows of a bank and kept going. And although we talk a lot about the CVS, you know, there was not nearly as much looting as often people think that there was. They were acting out because that was the only way they could act out. And again, I'm not saying I'm condoning it. I'm just saying that I think this is a pivotal moment, and that if we don't take advantage of it, then we have a problem. We now have had the time to look beneath the surface of our long-held attitudes about a lot of things. And so you have the surface disrupted. We can peek in between and say, why would somebody do that? What is the logic system? What is the situation where someone would do that? And a lot of that behavior, maybe not on that scale, gets excused in other environments. We all know adolescent boys who destroyed property and, you know, their parents fixed it and that they went on with it. And so I think if we start with the position that people tend to act very reasonably in the situations in which they found themselves and try to understand that, that is the opportunity that we have right now.
I'd forgotten who the Orioles were playing that night. Were they playing the Boston Red Sox?
They were playing the Sox.
Because last night, 2 years later, Adam Jones, mm-hmm. all-star outfielder for the Baltimore Orioles, is in center field putting up with hecklers who were evidently hurling racial epithets at him.
Nothing.
In the park. I mean, has anything changed?
Nothing.
Since like 1968, since 1947 with Jackie Robinson. I mean, it's amazing to think that that's still happening in a major city in America today.
Yes. I mean, I'm not that surprised. But just to respond to what you asked Dr. Pox, I just actually wrote some things down real quick that came to mind when you first said how some of your listeners are responding to it being called the uprise, right? So, number one, why does every black person always have to be thrown into a box? You know, this is the problem with representation. Okay, so one group of people may have tore down some stores, but that didn't cover everything. And if you watch the news, then that's probably what you took from it, because they report the negative. Even when the trials was going on a year later, they were showing images of what happened the previous year just to try to make it look like the city was out of control. And that wasn't true. So, you know, people need to check where they get their sources from.
What do you mean? But the city was out of control for a few days.
No. When the trials was going on.
No.
They were showing footage from the previous year.
Yeah.
And that wasn't really.
But during the trials, the city was not out of control, although people suspected it might get out of control.
William Porter's trial ended in a hung jury, and some agencies reported that the city had went back into the place it was in 2015, and they were on alert for another disturbance, and it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So which goes into the problem of like how representation happens in our community. If Al Sharpton says, "Dear President Trump, the blacks need this," you know, people are going to immediately look at me and Dr. Pox and say, "Hey, we know what you guys need. Al Sharpton told us." You know what I'm saying? And his reality is not even close to mine. Number two is the rules of the game. If somebody's punching you in your face your whole life, punching your father in his face his whole life, punching your grandmother and your grandfather in the face the whole life, when you get a chance to swipe back, any person who's in that right frame of mind is going to. It is what it is. Which brings me to number three. in Baltimore City really wasn't a riot. Nobody died but Freddie Gray. Nobody was really held accountable except for the kids who broke up, who cut the fire hose and trashed that CVS. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, you know.
In the riots surrounding Rodney King 25 years ago, it's another anniversary we've been recognizing. There's only 60 people died in that.
Yeah. So when you call it, you know, you're talking a couple million dollars worth of damage versus over $100 million in damage. So it's kind of not even really fair to call it a real riot. And then, which brings me to the last point is, why do these police officers always get to be noble? Like, how come we get to, you know, we use that word noble? Is these people who participated in this uprise aren't noble? Well, why are these cops who were incompetent, goofy, out of control, and basically responsible for a man's life still get to be noble? I mean, you know, they vilify Freddie Gray in the media who, you know, he was painted as some wild, out of control criminal who with this crazy arrest record when he was just a victim of the war on drugs. He was just taken advantage of in a system where if he was a white kid on Johns Hopkins campus walking to the gym, you know, he'd have been fine. But being as though he's in West Baltimore and he gets locked up with small amounts of marijuana, whatever his charges was, he has to be some type of criminal. But at the same time, Lieutenant Rice, who was one of the people that was responsible for his death, was he was a drunk. He got arrested for drunk driving. He stalked his not his ex-wife, but like his baby mother. He would pop up at her house 2 o'clock in the morning, screaming things, yelling, saying, "I work for the Baltimore City Police. Y'all can't tell me what to do," but not giving his name or his number. He wasn't a good citizen. Freddie Gray was liked in his community. I don't think people like Rice anywhere, you know, but they like that badge. So he gets a chance to wear that badge and be knowable. And that's kind of where the problem comes from. It's like, we don't really get the full scope of these stories, but then we just sit back and we're able to just pick, I'm gonna pluck a little bit from Fox. I'm gonna pluck a little bit from NBC. MSNBC, I'm going to pluck a little bit from CNN, I'm going to pluck a little bit from NPR, and I know what happened, and that's not really the case, so we got to give people a chance to be able to, like, you know, understand what's really going on.
And we are going to keep on plucking, as it were, as soon as we come back from a break. Dee Watkins is a columnist for Salon and the author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America, and The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland. She's also an associate professor in the Department of American Studies. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you want to follow us on Twitter, and we hope you will, @MiddayTomHall. Stick around. We will be right back.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Coming up on the program tomorrow, by the way, we're going to spend the hour with Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. Earlier this year, Judge James Bredar signed off on the city's consent decree with the Department of Justice. Mayor Pugh and Commissioner Davis have vowed to enact widespread reforms within the department. So can the reforms outlined in the consent decree build trust between officers and communities of color? Kevin Davis joins me tomorrow to take my questions and your calls and comments tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's our connector-in-chief and the associate dean at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland, the author of a terrific book called Fierce Angels, Living with the Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to This Strong Black Woman. Dee Watkins also joins us here in Studio A. He's the author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America, and The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. He's also an editor-at-large at Salon.com, and he's on the faculty at the University of Baltimore. You are welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. So, Sherry Parks, let's go back to the uprising the 2 days before Freddie Gray's funeral, Saturday night. There were some people outside of Camden Yards. There was a little bit of violence. You mentioned a bank got their windows smashed. But by and large, the entire day of protests that day had been quite peaceful. But that did kind of get lumped together with 2 days later, Monday. Mm-hmm. I mean, Freddie Gray's funeral was at like 11 o'clock in the morning. And by the afternoon, we had the kids from Douglas High School going to Mondawmin Mall. We had the buses not going anywhere from Mondawmin Mall. And then that came down the street to the CVS, you know, at the corner of Pennsylvania and North. And as we say, the rest is history. But it's important to understand the whole context of everything that happened there.
Well, and yes, exactly. That is a much more complex story. For instance, I want to be careful that we don't suggest that those were the kids from Douglas High School who we saw looting at Mondawmin Mall,
because
they were different people. And,
right.
And the kids from Douglas have been very careful to say that was not us. We have to change the narrative, because the default seems to be that there were kids, they looted, and that's the end of story. So we need to get beneath
that. That's been proven
the
beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Right. We need to, but I think people may, you put those two things together in a sentence and people, and I think that's what Dee is talking about, that there's a default category that seems to we fall back into if we don't continue to disrupt that. And for instance, what I heard Dee saying was that the collective memory of the uprising is really that of the riot, that even in the news, when they're talking about the uprising, they don't show the marchers because that's not exciting. What they show is really the rioting, which was a small piece of, as I said, different people. And even when we say, and we all say this, the police were ready for more violence and nothing happened. Well, actually quite a lot happened. There were tears there. I mean, there was disappointment. There was lots of talking, but that doesn't rise to the level.
This is after the trials of the officers
right.
indicted.
Yeah, over and over. There were people who were weeping. There were people who were calling each other. There were people who were commiserating. There were very emotional moments one by one as officers were acquitted or not charged. But that doesn't rise to the level of news. We have used African-American violence and pain as entertainment. And when they don't display that in ways that the larger audience is ready to see it or be entertained by it, and I'm using the term entertained loosely, but interested in, then so we don't understand the complexity and the intelligence that's often at work.
Yeah, and Davon Love was on the show yesterday, I guess, with Ray Kelly and Elder Harris from Sandtown. And they're talking about Davon often talks about the marketing, the commercial monetization, if you will, of black poverty, of inequality, of poorness in this country and in this city. You're working at Salon on a podcast series called Undisclosed, and this year they're taking up the story of Freddie Gray. Have you all in the reporting there unearthed new facts, new things that can shed light on what happened in that incident on the 12th of April, 2015?
Yeah, we did something that a lot of news outlets didn't really do, and that's show the human side of Freddie and uplift the voices of the people in that community. A lot of those people who didn't really get an opportunity to go to court and tell their stories, people who actually witnessed what happened, people who actually saw that knee put into his back and who saw his body being dragged, and people who never really got a chance to say, well, you know, I was there that day. This is what actually happened. So we got the opportunity to, you know, people like Mr. Harold Perry, who didn't get a chance to go to court and testify, to tell his story. And I think that's more important than anything, on top of the fact that there's so many people in Baltimore City who are sitting over Central Booking right now because they were locked up with a knife that was legal, the same type of knife that was supposedly, I had to look at all the research, I don't even think it was Freddie Gray's knife, but that's another story. A lot of people in Baltimore City are sitting over Central Booking right now because of a legal knife. You know, switchblades are illegal, and I've been in the streets my whole life, like forever, since I was an infant, and I probably only seen like two or three real switchblades, like the, you know, like the Fonzie, like, you want some trouble? Like one of them type of joints, you know, with the button and it flick out. These are the spring-assisted knives where you gotta press the button down and then pull it out. Those knives are legal. You can get them at any 7-Eleven, at any gas station, at any CVS, whatever. They got buckets of them sitting on the countertop. So kids from neighborhoods, black neighborhoods, black kids from black neighborhoods buy these knives, and police officers locked them up for them, and they said they switchblades. And anybody in their right mind know it's not a switchblade. You just trying to boost your arrest stats and all that, and just lock people up. So, you know, we got a chance to talk to a knife expert and to talk to people who create policy and challenge them on, yo, why are you allowing so many people to be locked up for knives that are legal? You know, like, you can't take a jog in your neighborhood if you're black, or you can't get caught with a knife that they sell at every corner store in the world if you're black. So we were able to have that conversation too, on top of the fact of deconstructing the officers, and that, you know, some of these officers involved in this case had terrible records. Even Commissioner Batts at the time, hell, he couldn't keep a job for more than a few years. He had a terrible record. So all of these people who got a chance to try to demonize some of the people caught up in a situation didn't really have pretty colorful award-winning backgrounds. They were, you know, it's pretty dirty people.
Yeah, then it gets into this whole, you know, what a person did the day before an incident, you know, or 2 weeks before, or 10 years before, including Freddie Gray. I mean, how does that pertain to, I mean, here he was hanging around, it was a Sunday morning, he's walking around, and he was involved in an arrest that involved six people. He's a perfectly healthy 25-year-old guy before the arrest, and after it, he's in a coma, and a week later, he's dead. There is no accounting for that death to mm-hmm. this day. I mean, so whether he was a good guy, a bad guy, it doesn't seem to matter, to me at least, that he was innocent on that day. And you know, that accounting, that being held accountable for in the police department. And of course, the consent decree is an effort to hold the police accountable. I mean, if in fact the disruption about our notion of race, if we've upended our the way we think about race, what, does that really mean that the people who've upended the way they think about race is the white community? Is that what that really means?
Well, I want to be clear that upending is actually just the first part, because all things being the same, it'll settle back into the same routine. Cultures have this way of, they're elastic like rubber bands. They'll snap back to whatever the old system used to be. And remember, people kept saying, well, let's get back to the way it was before. No, that's not really what we want, is for things to get back the way before. But disruption is simply an opportunity for these discussions like we're having today. It was interesting. About a month ago, I was in a room full of people who were in Jungian analysis. I was just, you know, a guest at a talk, and it was full of white, affluent, well-educated people who were in pain, because the speaker had suggested to them that there was a little Donald Trump in all of them. And first they pushed back, but they were in pain. And that idea that the social reality of Black America and the social reality of white America are closer now than they've been ever. Although I now understand how people stand by and let atrocities happen because it doesn't affect their day-to-day lives. I never used to understand that, and I understand that now. But for me saying now, I see it.
Why do you understand that now? I mean,
changed? There are people who... we are now witnessing white supremacists have taken what we now euphemistically call the alt-right, have taken this moment to kind of rise up and say some really awful things. They were always there. And there were people who knew that they were saying these awful things, and they aligned themselves with the president, and who were willing to look away or even agree in their heart of hearts. And so if you think about something like slavery, I mean, there were lots of people who didn't own slaves who tolerated it or benefited mm-hmm. from it indirectly. And I never emotionally understood that. Historically, obviously, it's there. But I now have a deeper understanding of how that happens, how otherwise good white people, because I've been saying for years that white people need to take their race back, you know, decent white people need to take their race back. But how they stand aside and let things happen because it doesn't affect their day-to-day lives in the way it affects
The country was built on the backs of slaves. Whether you own them or not, benefited from the...
Bill O'Reilly says they're interns who were paid and fed well.
And notice we are having these discussions for the first time in the history of this country. We're turning around and facing, at some level, slavery full in the face. We're having these discussions now when we haven't had them before. And maybe that's because I'm an academic, and universities are doing that. I mean, they're looking around and seeing how slavery built their universities. But we couldn't do that.
Georgetown University just last week.
Or Brown. We couldn't do that 20 years ago.
Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. Dee Watkins is here as well. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday and the Culture Connections. Let's go to the phone. Dave in Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Dee Watkins and Sherry Parks.
Thank you, Tom. Very pertinent program. Few scattered thoughts. I think Cornel West could say some good things about it. Change, I'm thinking. What change has there been? Yeah, there's been change. There's been no dollar bills. You know, Tom, there's enough money in this city to solve the problem. I wish you would bring some real solution talk onto your program. That is, persons who would take risks like we did in the 60s, picking better targets rather than CVS, how about a Wells Fargo bank, filling the streets with radical, militant, civil disobedience. And I'm bringing up the word militant, and I just think, you know, but you can't be negative. You can't be negative on your program, nor your guests, because they'll alienate people.
Dave, why don't you stick to what you think, and we'll deal with what we think on this side. So I appreciate your point, and you know, Dee Watkins, the notion that somehow we've made progress racially is a notion that people, you know, latched onto with the election of Barack Obama in 2008. They've latched onto it because we're having this, you know, this greater conversation about race. But as Sherry mentions, you know, now the country via the Electoral College elects a guy who was a lightning rod, who was a bringer togetherer of very, very saliently racist people, and he's now in the White House, and his party controls the Senate and the Congress.
Everybody loves a cool black guy. That's not new. You know, that's not like a new thing. If you can talk, or if you slick, or if you can dance, or if you slam dunking, like it's easy to love a cool black guy. That's not like a, you know, people think that they're progressive because they've had a conversation with me at Red Emma's or something. Like, that don't make you progressive because, like, I'm a public figure. People know who I am, so it doesn't count. Now, if you're having that same conversation with the dude that's on the out front, you know, trying to figure out how he going to make it from Monday to Wednesday, then that's a different story. That's progressive. It was a book event where this lady was telling me, like, she my biggest fan in the world. She read everything I ever wrote in my life. I'm the best person, this, that, and the third, and invited me out for a drink. And I was like, yo, you know, I appreciate you for reading my work with all due respect, but, like, I'm not really going out for no drinks or nothing like that. I seen the same person a couple of weeks later, and I spoke right next to the bookshop, and she looked at me like I was a great robber. She took off, and then she turned around and was like, oh, I didn't know that was you. Something, something, something. And I'm like, yo, it's the same thing. Like, being my friend don't count. Or, like, a lot of them people who voted for Trump probably voted for Obama. I mean, it was like an American story, you know? It was, you know.
Well, certainly some of them did.
You know, for sure. So, you know, I think that it's a unique time for us, again, for us who care, because it's us who, like Davon said, want to monetize off of all of these situations, and then it's us who really want to make a difference. And I think for us who really want to make a difference, it's not even our business to pay attention to the people trying to monetize, because that's just take too much time, take time away from us working. But it's time, we need to reevaluate the way we want to make change and work hard. That's why I try to do what I do with books and schools and working with kids and all that. Like, that's what the best I have to offer, you know what I mean? But then I know other people who offer different things, and that's the best they have too. So I try to play that game.
All right, we got to take another break. We will come back with more with Dr. Sherry Parks, an associate professor and associate dean for research, interdisciplinary scholarship, and programming at the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland, College Park, and Dee Watkins. He's written a couple of books called The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America, and The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. He's also a lecturer in the School of Communications Design at the University of Baltimore and the founder of the Be More Writers Project. More with Sherry Parks and Dee Watkins. 410-662-8780 is how you can join our conversation. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. We'll be right back.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, it's this month's installment of the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. She's an Associate Dean for Research, Interdisciplinary Scholarship, and Programming at the College of Arts and Humanities over in College Park, and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And Sherry, you're also sponsoring another annual Think-a-thon, which happens on Friday down at Westminster Hall. You've been doing this for several years. Let's talk a little bit about what's involved in that event. You bring together a lot of artists and folks, and you deal with issues that are not necessarily directly related to the arts.
Right, exactly. It's the idea that artists push people outside the box. That's why the artists are there, not necessarily talking about art. Although this is our fifth year of doing Think-a-thon, and we bring together activists and scholars and artists, as you said, and funders, but you can't ask for money that day. And it's a think and do day, so we've always had short-term and long-term outcomes. So we create a venue and give good food and help people focus in on problems. We don't predetermine the problems. And so please, you know, people, if we'll give you the link and people can register so we know how much lunch to buy.
We'll put it on our
website.
And
a lot of the response of the community to the uprising and the conditions that led to the uprising, that I always put their face in there, have come out of the Think-a-thons.
Dee Watkins is here as well. He's the author of The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America and The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. He also teaches at the University of Baltimore and serves as the editor-at-large at Salon.com. And Dee, you've got a program where you're putting copies of your books into the Baltimore City Public Schools. How's that work?
So to date, I'm very lucky and very fortunate, not just in Baltimore, but outside of Baltimore. I think I visited like over 150 schools within the last year and a half. So I got a chance to meet students all over the country. And my books are pretty much in every high school and a couple of middle schools in Baltimore City. Which is even more cool is that the same book that City Springs and NAFT had used to teach their students about some of these issues was also being used by some sociology classes at Harvard. So it's like the rare opportunity to have the Ivy League cardigan monocled sweater people and the kids from East Baltimore reading the same thing, which is probably something that doesn't really happen a lot. I've been able to donate a lot of these books through Penn Faulkner Writers in Schools and Hooks Books for Prairie Hooks up in D.C. and Penn Faulkner Writers in Schools in D.C. So I've been able to work with them to help donate a lot of books. But then I did a GoFundMe to raise books for some young women at the Baltimore Leadership Academy, because one of my friends is a basketball coach there. And he saw like a group of girls sharing one of my books. And I was like, yo, that's crazy. He said, yeah, yo, it's like 18 of them passing it around. And I was like, that shouldn't be like that. And I was communicating with him on how we can get them some books. So we did the GoFundMe. We just dropped off like 90 books to them. And I'm going to give a talk with them to the girls in the school on May 17th. But I'm also bringing in some people from downtown. Tierra Elise, shout out to Downtown Locker Room. They're going to come through with gifts and like gift bags. And she's going to actually talk to the young women about being a young black woman who's an executive, who's in her 20s, who's controlling culture and participating in all type of community engagement outside of rhetoric. So it's like it's going to be a great day for me, and hopefully it's a great day for the young women at that school.
All right, and we'll have a link to both the Think-a-thon and to Dee's program for books in the schools on our website.
And I want to talk about, because that image of the girls passing your book around, I think is very profound. And I was thinking about for minority kids, often their classroom situation is very alien. And Dee has talked about this, about, I mean, you're given books that don't have you in them or don't. And that idea of pulling your culture into the classroom and talking about it and making links to the education is not something that many minority kids have. Education's over here, day-to-day life is over here. And we know, one, that stops a lot of the learning, because it's like learning a foreign language when you're an adult, is that there's this whole other thing. And so I think that's what's so profound about bringing in books. I mean, Dee is simultaneously as a senior editor at Salon, and he is, as he likes to say, he was born and he will die in East Baltimore, where kids will tell you they don't let us do things like that. I mean, that's a quote. They don't let us be college professors. They don't let us be doctors. And so the idea of bringing his book in, even just that act of bringing that book into the classroom, changes that.
It's another disruptive act.
Yeah, it's funny. So. No, it's funny. It's funny you guys worded it like that because kids loving or learning from or getting excited about the books their teachers assign is disruptive. No one's excited about The Crucible. No one's excited about Scarlet Letter. And it's nothing, no knock to those books or whatever, but it's like if you want a person to really fully understand the craft and the energy and the power and what went into creating a book like The Scarlet Letter or creating a book like The Crucible, you have to start at a place where kids can understand the basic fundamentals of developing those critical thinking skills to even be able to acknowledge that and receive it. So we're not even able to receive it because it's just not part of our culture. If I can go in my building in the 239 building and as a kid in middle school and count up $2,500 and buy a necklace and then ride my dirt bike all through the lobby, what are you going to do with Mark Twain? Like, it's not. But if I'm a person who's reading books like Sister Soldier, Coldest Winter Ever, or what's the Nathan McCall book that was out back in the day? Holler If You Hear Me or something like that. Make You Want to Holler. If I'm reading books like that, and you know, because these books were out when I was a kid, if I'm reading those books, then I'm like, yo, you know what? My story, it means something. It matters. And at the same time, you tricking me into learning because I'm developing those skills that's going to help me try to figure out, like, yo, so what's this guy Sherman Alexie talking about? Who's this guy Juno Diaz? What's Toni Morrison at? Like, you're learning these things and you're getting it, but we're not really getting it because we're not building a foundation in the proper way.
The ossification of education is something that, you know, I mean, you're in the academy, and so you know this better than I, but it is amazing that, you know, if I was reading about disaffected youth, reading about Holden Caulfield and The Catcher in the Rye when I was in the seventh grade, why are the kids still reading that? And some of them are. I mean, it's just, and how's a kid from East Baltimore going to relate to Holden Caulfield? I mean, it's just it's a crazy notion when there are so many other books, as you say, Sherman Alexie, Juno Diaz, people, et cetera.
That's why I use the term alien. And it's not that you want to be those people. It's that they just don't have much to say to you.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Byron in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Sherry Parks and Dee Watkins.
Hello, Dr. Parks and Mr. Watkins. Nice to talk to you. So my question is, how do you contend with people who don't agree with you? So as someone who definitely agrees with pretty much everything I've heard you talk about related to race relations in Baltimore and the world broadly, how would you talk to a Trump voter? And, you know, can you give me some situations or examples of how you contended with people who, you know, for one reason or another, just don't agree with you about Baltimore or about racialism broadly? Thank you.
I know you might not know this, but I'm going to tell you like something that a lot of people are starting to figure out slowly. I'm kind of funny. So like I did a book event at Fort Myers, Florida Book Festival. And when I first walked into the festival, I saw like 8 Make America Great Again hats. So when I got to my table, I was with this woman named Taya Kyle, who's the wife of American Sniper. And she has like 3 books out. And then they got that film. And everybody in the crowd, they was there to support her. And then when they, you know, read the little bios and they saw what I was about, they were prepared to resist me. And I was able to just crack some jokes about the president, make some jokes about Obama, and make some jokes about how at the end of the day, a lot of y'all people who supported Trump and then a lot of us people who are stuck in these type of situations, we have a lot in common. Social mobility is not a factor for us. And until we realize that, ain't none of us going to go nowhere. And I was able to, you know, use those jokes, but then make the bigger point. And I signed some books for like at least for a couple of people that was actually wearing Trump memorabilia, which actually blew my mind. So I think that Byron, I receive everybody. Like, you know, I'm willing to have a conversation because I understand that sometimes I'm wrong. Like, I don't always get it. And I learn stuff from everybody all of the time. And I think that mentality helps a lot, too, when we realize that we don't have all the answers.
I'm glad you went first because the audience can't see that, but Dee let me go first. And I said, no, you go first, because Dee is actually not only funny, he's actually very sweet and respectful. I don't know if I'm supposed to say it.
Thank you.
Change your persona.
Thank you.
And I think, by the way, Dee, you would rock a cardigan. But that's, just, but that's a whole other thing. That was in the other segment. So we'll pick that up later.
Yeah, perfect. Come on, Tom.
But what I would say, Byron, what I was going to say is one of the great secrets is how much people have in common. The people in the Midwest who are in despair and voted the way they did and are angry is because they have an awful lot in common with working class black people in Baltimore. And that's the point that I try to make is what they have in common, that kids in Cumberland and kids in East Baltimore have a lot in common because of the economic issues that they're having to face, and their communities are in despair. Mm-hmm.
And it was shocking to me that in the election, all of a sudden, the middle class became the white middle class, as if there was no black middle class or mm-hmm. black underclass or white underclass that needed to rise up. All of a sudden, middle class became a white thing, and it hadn't been a white thing for a long, long time.
I'm here to tell you, J.D. Vance is the white Steve Harvey.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's the same. It's the same thing. And I don't know how that got to be a voting block, but I think this is maybe like the second or third election that I voted in, and...
Because he's so old.
And since I've been voting, I've been always hearing about, when I first started voting, I watched a whole lot of Chris Matthews, and I always heard Chris Matthews challenge his guests by saying, what are you going to do about the hard working white middle class in Scranton? And I'm like, and I used to always wonder, like, yo, why does he keep talking about this hard working white class? Like the dude in the, across the hall from me ain't got 37 jobs. Like, yeah. What are you right. talking
that's
about?
That's the mythology.
You
know?
I want to talk about standards and double standards. It's interesting to me that we've just had the first 100 days of the Trump administration. It's fascinating to me how low the bar has been set for what counts as success in a Donald Trump administration. We hear all the time, black professionals will tell us all the time that they had to be twice as good, they had to be twice as expert, twice as erudite in order to get ahead
still
in
true.
Business. Of course, it's still true. And then we have Barack Obama coming out of, coming off of a vacation that he took after his presidency ended and involved in a controversy because he and his wife, Michelle Obama, are getting $60 million for a book deal. And it came to light that he's going to accept a $400,000 speaking fee to talk to Cantor Fitzgerald, which was financial firm that played very prominently in the September 11th attacks. I mean, that company came to light, came to prominence back then at 9/11. And there's all sorts of people hopped all over Barack Obama for taking money for being an ex-president making a speech. What do you think?
Well, first of all, yes, there is a double standard. And does that double standard operate in both white and some of those people who are attacking him are African-American, too, who will hold him up to a very, very high standard. I want to know what he's going to say as he can get into those elite spaces. And what I hope is that he will then say some things that are subversive, that he'll get them to think about things that they haven't thought before. Now, there's always a chance that you get co-opted by that space. And we'll see. But I think it's really important that we let him be a human, let him be a former president, and I want to see what he says and what he writes in those venues. The money is very interesting because we would not have batted an eye when George Bush does things, we don't bat an eye because that's the way it's supposed
Ronald
to go.
Ronald Reagan got $2 million for giving a speech in Japan
right.
after his presidency.
Right.
Yeah.
Wrong business.
I mean, it is interesting. I mean, of course, it's not only he has the opportunity to say some stuff that maybe hasn't been said to people at Cantor Fitzgerald, he also has an opportunity to use that money for Lord knows what good purposes, obviously.
He's exactly.
A foundation. So, but to begrudge him the dough seems a little bit... A little bit tough. I'm with him on that. I mean, as a musician,
who has
made most of my living gigging for a life. If you get a gig, take it.
And then the people who are making complaints, it's like, what are you doing with your money? What are you doing with your platform? Do you have money? Do you have a platform? Would you really reject it? Do the people who feel like they're taking a moral high ground by criticizing that, would you reject it? Have you ever even seen $400,000 before? You even know what it looked like?
Right.
So
all right, we got to call it a day. I appreciate both of you coming by. Dee Watkins, the author of a couple of great books, the last one called The Cook Up a Crack Memoir, and Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland in College Park. The Thinkathon happens Friday morning at 9 o'clock. We'll have a link on our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up on the program tomorrow, Police Commissioner Kevin Davis joins me for the hour. To date, 109 people have been killed in our city this year, a majority of them gunshot victims. We'll talk about the department's efforts to curb gun violence and the city's consent decree with the DOJ. Commissioner Davis will take your calls and comments and my questions tomorrow on Midday. I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guests today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours online at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.